You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The GX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including an annual tally of homeless people, Native American tribes running high-interest loan operations, and threats to diversity programs at universities. I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Roma Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
So, Jane, we'll start with you first. You published a feature this week about the point in time count. That's also called a pit count. First, can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, it's basically our country's way of tallying the number of homeless people in individual communities. And so the way it works is that every year, it's usually a night in January, groups set out across the country to count the number of homeless residents in their community. It's usually oftentimes a nonprofit or some other group that's in charge of the count in their county. They usually go out and do it overnight, the idea being that people have kind of settled in for the night and will be in one place and you can count them more easily. But of course, then you probably can't ask them questions necessarily. You don't want to wake up sleeping people. So I know Jackson County did theirs on Sunday, January 26th. I went out with a group in Grants Pass that was doing the Josephine County count that's run by the nonprofit UCAN, and they actually did it on a Wednesday during the day. And the thing that I find really interesting about it is that it's such a sort of ad hoc process. Like, there's just these small groups sort of spread out throughout the county, wandering around where homeless people probably will be, sort of calling out, hello, anybody here? And, you know, hopefully the team that you're with kind of has some knowledge of the people and where they might be. And then you're just tallying, you know, people that you talk to. They also have something called an unsheltered observation. So if you see a tent or a campsite, but there's no one there, you can still count that as clearly someone lives there. And so the group that I went out with had some resources. You have questions you're supposed to be asking people to get more information, more data about them. And so basically teams just kind of spread out across the county on that day trying to count people. And then all of that data is for the federal government. Like, that's the official count. It goes to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And that is our country's way of tracking how we're doing with the homeless crisis and assessing the problem and finding out where the funding needs to go.
So as you said, you went out with a group in Grants Pass trying to count homeless residents. What was that like?
It was really interesting. So I went out with a group people from two different nonprofits, ADAPT and UCAN, and we went to two different locations by the train tracks in Grants Pass where homeless people are likely to be and have lived. And they brought a wagon full of supplies to give out to people, tents and food and things to try to entice people to talk to them and answer the questions. Sometimes people don't want to answer the questions, but it's really just getting basic data points that can then be more data for the federal government. So we kind of just walked along looking in the brush by the train tracks and yelling for people and hoping that people would respond. We actually didn't find very many people the day that we went out. It was pretty cold, and also the city had cleared its largest homeless camp about 5 days before the point in time count and sort of dispersed the residents. So we were kind of looking for people. And then they actually had a count at the fairgrounds in Josephine County that day also. So there were services there and food and haircuts. So a lot of people went to the fairgrounds and got counted there instead. We were sort of out in the field looking for people. And it also turns out that the official pit count is a little bit more spread out than just that one day. They try to get most of it done kind of in one fell swoop. But you can actually count, I think the deadline this year was February 7th. If you know, these groups see people for their services or whatever, you have to ask and make sure they haven't already been counted so you're not double counted. But they're gathering all this data to then be submitted to HUD.
So as you said, this information is very important for policy decisions. What data do we have so far?
We don't have the official data yet for Josephine County. Last year's pit count counted 559 homeless people in Josephine County. I do have the data from last year in California. As a state, there were about 187,000 homeless people, according to the pit count. In Oregon, there were almost 23,000 homeless people last year's pit count. And so we'll have to see once the data has all been collected, what we get this year, and then what do we do to address that.
Great. Thanks, Jane.
Thanks. Justin, I'm going to turn around to you. You interviewed a reporter with ProPublica about their investigation into payday lending operations that are owned by tribes. What did you learn?
Yeah, so we talked about this industry that's made up of online lenders charging really high interest rates, like over 600% in some cases. One instance that Joel Jacobs, the reporter I talked to, told me about was this woman who borrowed $550 and was required to pay back more than $2,700 in her 9-month contract. So really high interest rates there. The length of these contracts are a bit longer than traditional payday loans, but it's a very similar business model. And this kind of lending it's regulated in many states, including California and Oregon. And they basically put caps on these interest rates, but there aren't noticeably any federal laws that exist to regulate this industry. And that's why businesses have found a home with some tribes. So tribes have something called sovereign immunity, which means they get some legal protection, for example, from state laws. And, you know, this doesn't mean they're sovereign countries, which I think some confuse this with. They still have to follow federal laws. Tribal land and reservations are part of the United States, but they can't be sued by private parties without the tribe's consent, basically. And these lending companies, which are mostly run by non-tribal members, have used that legal protection to partner with tribes. So the tribe will own the lending company, but a lot of the business is handled by non-tribal members, and the tribe basically gets a cut of that profit. It's online, like I mentioned, and they can lend to people around the country. It's a, you know, very opaque industry and hard to report on. There's no licenses for these businesses. There's virtually no public information available. So, you know, it's very hard to report, which is one reason why I reached out to the ProPublica reporter who did a very good job. And just to mention, there's relatively few tribes that are actually in this industry, like maybe a dozen out of hundreds of federally recognized tribes. But it is a big business that brings in a lot of revenue.
Okay. So you were interested in this topic because there is a tribe in Humboldt County that owns some of these lending companies. So like you said, there's very few tribes nationally that are doing this, but there is one in Humboldt County. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so months ago, actually, I requested a list of tribal-owned businesses from California because I was interested not only in payday lending, but I'd heard that businesses were using sovereign immunity. Other kinds of businesses were using the sovereign immunity kind of loophole. For example, like patents, and I heard about some medical companies interested in this. The state said they didn't have a list like that. So again, it can be really difficult to track these things and even find a list of tribally owned businesses in some states. So this ProPublica investigation, they focus mostly on this Wisconsin tribe, and that Wisconsin tribe's really into this industry. Their lending companies show up in around one out of every 100 bankruptcy cases in the country. So extremely widespread. But the ProPublica investigation also mentions Big Lagoon Rancheria in Humboldt County. So Big Lagoon is a small tribe. The information I found said it has less than 30 members, only 8 households. And I tracked down at least 9 online lenders that the tribe has owned over the last decade or so. So Vermont state officials actually listed a number of those companies as a warning to residents some years ago. Only 3 of those websites, those online lending websites, are still up. They all kind of look the same. They just have different names. They have, like, the same web design. They list the same address in Arcata. But, you know, the reporter I spoke with said these businesses can be pretty attractive to tribes who have limited economic opportunity. And that seems to apply to Big Lagoon. It's a small tribe, like I mentioned. It's also surrounded by forests, by redwoods, by protected lands. It's pretty remote. And these businesses can bring in a lot of money that tribes use to fund social services. So it's not really surprising that we would find these businesses at Big Lagoon.
Yeah, that's interesting. So is there anything being done to regulate this industry?
No, like I mentioned, there aren't federal laws that cap interest rates for online lenders currently, although our senator here in Oregon, Jeff Merkley, has for a while now tried to get something passed. But those laws haven't gone anywhere. The payday loan industry spends a lot of money on lobbying. They fight pretty hard to keep federal laws from passing. There has been a successful federal court case that says online lenders have to follow federal laws on bankruptcy and collections. But as of now, it doesn't look like this industry is going anywhere, despite more press and pushback against it.
Cool. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you. Roman, it's your turn. You talked to Southern Oregon University President Rick Bailey this week about how the university is responding to dramatic shifts in federal policy we've seen since Trump took office recently. What did he say?
Yeah, so essentially he said that the university is staying the course right now and that they're not changing anything yet. You know, SOU is very strong on diversity and inclusion programs, and that's something that Trump has been against. And he said that they don't really want to change anything right now unless they're forced to. I sat in on this closed meeting with over 100 staff and faculty where Bailey was taking questions. They also talked about how the university will respond to protect undocumented students. Say, you know, if immigration enforcement shows up, the university sent out an email a couple weeks ago telling everyone about their rights to contact university lawyers to not let these immigration officials in, what the difference is between a public and a private space and things like that.
Yeah, that seems helpful. What kinds of policy changes has Trump made so far that could affect public universities?
Yeah, so there are obviously big efforts to kill diversity, equity, and inclusion programs across the federal government. And that also means not using federal funds to support them either. And a lot of federal funds go to universities like SOU. So in one of his first executive orders, Trump ordered the halting of federal funds to DEI programs at universities. He gave the Department of Education and the Attorney General 180 days to give guidance to schools about what should happen related to DEI programs and also affirmative action. And so that will probably happen around mid-May. Right now, no public universities in Oregon have shuttered their DEI offices yet and haven't seemed to make any changes. Rick Bailey had talked about not wanting to participate in what's called anticipatory compliance, which is what we've seen happen as Trump has taken office, where some businesses or agencies might change how they operate or what they do in anticipation of what Trump might do rather than, you know, him ordering them to do something.
Right. Yeah, we've seen a lot of that. What kind of power does the university actually have to resist Trump's policies?
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing is they can't really do much if their funding is on the line. You know, SOU, like most public universities, need federal funding to survive. A lot of students rely on federal loans to go to college. Universities get federal grants for research. So if the Trump administration says they have to choose between federal funds or their DEI office, they're going to have to close the office. But Rick Bailey had said that he wants to find a way to continue promoting SOU's values, even if they're forced to change. The thing is we don't really know what that would look like. He didn't really have an answer to that yet, but that's something that him and, you know, the administration are thinking about, and it sounds like other universities, at least in Oregon, are thinking about that too.
Right, so very much up in the air there. You also did a spot this week on a historic agreement signed by Humboldt County supervisors. What was that agreement all about?
Yeah, so there's these two dams on the Eel River, which stretches from Mendocino County up just south of Eureka in Humboldt County. And these dams have been there for over 120 years.
Wow.
And during that time, they've been used to divert water from the Eel River to the Russian River, which is on the other side of the hill, the other watershed. And that water is then primarily used for irrigation downstream through, you know, Mendocino, Sonoma, Marin counties. It's the water's also used to generate electricity, or it used to be. And this has kind of long been a conflict between Humboldt County and their neighboring county south. Humboldt County has been opposed to these diversions since at least the 1920s. And recently, PG&E, which operates the dams, wants to decommission them because they no longer generate electricity. The infrastructure is failing. So this agreement spells out how these water diversions will work moving forward, and that'll kind of pave the way to removing these dams. You know, Humboldt County supervisors said they didn't like everything about the agreement, but they said it was worth it to remove the dams, which is something they've wanted to do.
And why is removing these dams so important?
Yeah, so like the water diversions, Humboldt County has opposed removing these dams, or has opposed these dams themselves for a century. Originally, it was for economic reasons. You know, pulling water out of the Eel River means less water downstream for fish spawning, fishing, recreation, drinking water, sewage. And these dams are in Mendocino County, but the river mostly heads down through Humboldt. And nowadays, there's also a conservation aspect to it. You know, reports show that the Eel River has historically been a big spawning ground for salmon, but now the levels of salmon there are a tiny fraction of what they used to be, and salmon fishing is a very big industry in the region and historically important for tribes. So the county wants to increase water flows to help protect salmon.
And can you explain a bit more about the details of this water diversion agreement?
Yeah, it's a little bit wonky. It kind of boils down to less water will be diverted from the river. The water is going to be pulled more in the winter and the spring when the water levels are high and won't impact the salmon as much. And there's also more cutoffs to prevent water from draining. PG&E will also transfer their water rights to the Round Valley Indian tribes, which will use the money to fund restoration projects. And so we probably won't see the removal of these dams until at least 2028, you know, as the process kind of gets going.
Well, thank you so much, Roman. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.